from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! We're on the road in Minneapolis.
Do things that, you know, make people upset. My political views or my humanist views have caused me a lot of censorship. But I don't have a problem with that. I mean, it isn't right, but what I would have more of a problem is if I had to look back in my life and say, yeah, I compromised here, and yeah, I did this so I could get that. Once you start doing that, it's like a house of cards. It all falls apart.
Patti Smith, today a Democracy Now! Special with the singer-songwriter, poet, artist, and punk rock legend on singing and speaking out. But first, we'll be joined by the attorney who uncovered documents that fueled the latest wave of sexual allegations against the Catholic Church. He says all roads lead to Rome. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Coast Guard is warning the oil spill from an offshore well in the Gulf of Mexico could be five times worse than previously thought. Rear Admiral Mary Landry made the announcement while also disclosing a new breach has been discovered in the underwater well.
Specifically, BP has just briefed me on a new location of an additional breach in the riser of the deep underwater well. While BP believes, and we believed, and established a 1,000-barrel-per-day estimate of what is leaking from the well, NOAA experts believe the output can be as much as 5,000 barrels.
11 workers remain missing from the explosion that set the rig on fire before sinking into the Gulf last week. The workers are presumed dead. The oil slick, meanwhile, continues to approach the Louisiana coast, with fears it could reach the shoreline by Friday night. On Capitol Hill, Republicans have ended their filibuster of a financial reform bill after 3 days. On Wednesday, Republicans allowed Democrats to advance the measure to the Senate floor, but vowed to continue opposing several provisions, including new curbs on the trading of derivatives. The Justice Department is considering filing a lawsuit to thwart a new law in Arizona that forces police officers to determine the immigration status of someone they suspect of being an undocumented immigrant. Opponents call it the harshest anti-immigrant measure in the country and a license for racial profiling. The Washington Post reports government officials are considering making the case that the law intrudes on federal enforcement of immigration laws. President Obama, meanwhile, has suggested he may delay a push for immigration reform until next year. Obama spoke to reporters aboard Air Force One.
We've gone through a very tough year, and I've been working Congress pretty hard. So I know there may not be an appetite immediately to dive into another controversial issue. There's still work that has to be done on energy. Midterms are coming up. So I don't want us to do something just for the sake of politics that doesn't solve the problem.
Sit down anytime. The federal government has approved the nation's first offshore wind farm near Cape Cod, Massachusetts. On Wednesday, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said the Cape Wind project would mark a major step toward a green energy economy.
Cape Wind will be the United States' first offshore wind farm, supplying clean power to homes and businesses in Massachusetts while creating good jobs here in America. This will be the first of many projects up and down the Atlantic coast, which I expect will come online in the years ahead as we build a new energy future for our country.
The decision had been delayed for nearly a year amidst opposition from two native tribes over the project's impact. In a statement, Kurt Davies of the environmental group Greenpeace USA praised the announcement, saying, quote, "There could be no clearer direction for America's energy future and global warming leadership. President Obama should think twice about opening the door to more risky offshore drilling and prioritize renewable energy projects like Cape Wind instead." In Israel and the occupied territories, a young Palestinian man was killed in the Gaza Strip Wednesday when Israeli troops opened fire on a nonviolent protest. The victim, Ahmed Salam, was shot as he and other demonstrators planted Palestinian near the border wall, sealing off Gaza from Israel. They were protesting an Israeli policy barring anyone in Gaza from entering an area within several hundred yards of the wall. Eva Bartlett, an international solidarity activist living in Gaza, took part in the protest.
These are nonviolent demonstrations against the Israeli imposition of the buffer zone. The buffer zone is a 300-meter no-go zone in which the Israelis say they can shoot anyone in this area. But it annexes Palestinian farmland, it annexes land where Palestinians live and work.
In Mexico, two human rights activists have been shot dead in the state of Oaxaca. The victims have been identified as Beatriz Carino, director of the Mexican human rights group Cactus, and Yuri Antero Jacola, a human rights observer from Finland. They were traveling as part of a convoy attempting to deliver aid to a town that's been targeted by paramilitary blockades since the 2006 uprising against Governor Ulysses Ruiz. Gabriela Jimenez of the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca described the attack.
When the driver tried to reverse, his tires were gone, and he couldn't get up because they were attacking from the front. It was then our colleagues, Beatriz Carino and Yuri Jacola, died. They were hit in the head, as far as we know.
Two Mexican journalists who were covering the humanitarian convoy have also been reported missing since the attack. The Obama administration is seeking to force a New York Times reporter to reveal his sources for a 2006 book on the CIA. The reporter, James Risen, has been subpoenaed to testify next month before a Virginia grand jury about his sources for a chapter on the CIA's role in disrupting Iran's nuclear program. Risen says he won't comply with the subpoena and will seek its dismissal. Republican Congressmember Duncan Hunter of California is under criticism for saying he would support deporting the U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants. Hunter made the comments at a gathering of the right-wing Tea Party group on Saturday.
"But I support the deportation of natural-born American citizens that are the kids of illegal aliens."
"Yes."
"I would have to, yes. Yeah. I think would have to. And let me tell you why. You know, this is a—it's a complex issue. And it's, you know, you can look and say, you're a mean guy. You know, that's a mean thing to do. That's not a humanitarian thing to do. We simply cannot afford what we're doing right now. We just can't afford it. California's going under."
And at the University of California, Berkeley, the Student Senate has failed to override a veto of a measure calling for divestment from companies linked to Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Last month, the president of the student government vetoed a bill urging the school to divest from General Electric and United Technologies for the company's, quote, "military support of the occupation of the Palestinian territories." Earlier today, the Student Senate voted 13-5 to bypass the veto, one vote shy of the total necessary for an override. The vote was held at around 4 in the morning local time following a lengthy session attended by over 200 people. San Francisco State graduate student Jacqueline Husari spoke out in favor of the divestment call.
"Divestment is not an act of aggression.
as some may claim. Rather, it is a nonviolent act that precludes aggression against innocent, powerless people with names and real faces. You can no longer feign indifference or ignorance, but from this point on, you need to realize the consequences of your choices on real people, and that the choice to continue investing incontrovertibly equals an act of aggression. Blood will forever be on your hands if you don't make the right choice tonight. Thank you.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're on the road in Minneapolis. I'm Amy Goodman. As we begin today with a look at the wave of sexual abuse allegations against Catholic priests all over the world. Earlier this month, Pope Benedict told victims of sexual abuse by priests in Malta that the church was doing all it could to investigate the abuse accusations and bring those responsible to justice. But new revelations and claims of abuse continue to rock the Vatican. An investigation by the Associated Press suggests that Pope Benedict's hand-picked replacement to oversee abuse cases at the Vatican did nothing to restrict a California priest after learning that he had previously molested a 13-year-old boy. As the scandal spreads across Europe and Latin America, bishops in Ireland, Germany, and Belgium have resigned, and new abuse allegations are emerging in Norway and Chile. Here in the United States, an alleged victim of priest abuse in Wisconsin announced a lawsuit against the Vatican last week. The lawsuit alleges that Pope Benedict, in his former role as Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, and two senior Vatican officials failed to act when the Wisconsin Church reported the alleged abuse by the late Father Joseph Murphy in the 1990s. The Vatican says the lawsuit is without merit and, quote, rehashes old theories already rejected by U.S. courts. Well, for more, I'm joined here in Minneapolis by Jeff Anderson. He's a St. Paul-based attorney who's filed hundreds of lawsuits alleging sexual abuse by priests and bishops since 1983. He filed last week's lawsuit against the Vatican in a Milwaukee court and wants the church to release any files it has on sexual abuse cases involving priests. It was his discovery of previously undisclosed documents that fueled the latest wave of accusations leading all the way up to the Vatican. Jeff Anderson, we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's very good to have you with us. Okay, why don't you lay out the documents that you have uncovered?
Well, the most recent documents involving Lawrence Murphy out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, have revealed to us, as we had known before, there is a direct documentary link from the cover-up of the priests at the local level by the archbishop to the Vatican, and in that case, it directly implicates then-Cardinal Ratzinger and all those at the Department of the CDF at the Vatican.
Explain CDF.
CDF is a congregation for the doctrine of faith appointed by the pontiff to really keep these matters under secrecy seals and to investigate them to avoid scandal. And what the documents show us, as we have known for 25 years, is that the Vatican is really intending to keep the reputation of the clerics and the Catholic Church intact. And while doing so, they are really imperiling the well-being of the children worldwide.
How did you get involved with this case?
Well, this case is one of many we have been working on for 25 years. And the case involving Lawrence Murphy in particular, the documents came to us in forced discovery as a result of suits we brought some years ago. And these are documents that were just revealed to us in the case brought in Milwaukee, which is one of many that have been brought across the country. What we're learning and what we have known to be the case for 25 years is that all roads are leading to Rome, that the decisions are made at the top of the pyramid by the Vatican. What we know is that the documentary trails that are being revealed are showing that just like Lawrence Murphy and Archbishop Weakland covering up locally, they're doing so under directions from Rome, from the pontiff, from the pope and his predecessor. And their directions and their laws and their protocols, which is what's so alarming, require every cleric, every bishop, every cardinal, all the way to Rome, to keep these matters secret, to avoid scandal of the universal church. And in so doing, their concern is more about their reputation than the well-being of the children.
I was just in Wisconsin last night. Milwaukee, the story of this priest, lay it out in detail.
Well, Lawrence Murphy was a priest that was in charge of the deaf school at St. John's in Milwaukee, and he had many kids there who were impaired by reason of the fact they could not speak, and particularly vulnerable, most of them Catholic. He would roam the dorms at night, picking out kids that he chose, and clearly is revealed to everyone there that he abused not dozens, but hundreds of kids that became known in the 50s, 60s, 70s. In the mid-70s, scandal was about to break, and they moved him to another location at another place in Wisconsin. Then in the mid-90s, scandal was about to break again, and at that time, the archbishop couldn't control the outbreak of scandal, so he sought the assistance of Cardinal Ratzinger, then at the Vatican, and said, you need to take jurisdiction on this. We have to avoid scandal and remove this priest. Cardinal Ratzinger, through his deputy and others, made a decision at that time, while knowing that he abused many, many kids over many decades, became more concerned about their reputation, and thus, as the documents have revealed to us, made the decision that they will keep Lawrence Murphy in ministry because it would be more scandalous to remove him than to keep him. So they allowed him to stay in ministry, in good standing, until his death, all the while ignoring the pleas of countless families and kids who were suffering in secrecy and silence and some shame.
The Catholic Church talks about, forgiveness and wanting to give these priests a chance, one of the things that they have said. Yet when they discover a gay priest, they are out immediately. Not the same when it comes to a pedophile.
Well, there are some deep contradictions in their particular theology, but what concerns us and the survivors most is their concern about a reputation. And when they discover an offending priest versus a gay priest, let's say, but an offending priest, a priest that commits crimes, they're more concerned about concealing the crimes and protecting that priest and protecting their reputation than they are about removing that priest and or reporting them to the law enforcement authorities, which they never, ever, if rarely, do.
Explain this latest wave of allegations. I mean, they've been coming out over years, but this one clearly is a tidal wave that the church now, going to the highest levels, has to deal with. What started this?
Well, I think the latest wave of allegations coming to the fore that are right now on the stream of public consciousness in the U.S. and worldwide is really an accumulation of information that has come to us and the survivors working with us and others through the lawsuits brought that have revealed documents and patterns and practices that have shown that time and time again, not tens or dozens of times, but hundreds and thousands of times, when a priest offends, they are required by their superiors, from the bishop to the Vatican, to keep that secret. And that's under protocols and laws developed by the pontiff, by the Vatican, that says, we are required to avoid scandal, to protect the reputation of the church, and in so doing, are embedded with an ethos, a norm that says, we move the priest, avoid scandal, do not report it to anybody outside of clerical culture, and continue to meet, move, and protect the priest without regard to the well-being of the children. And that's why we see so many priests being recycled by so many bishops worldwide, because the Vatican requires them to make a vow of silence, to make a promise of secrecy, and to be absolutely obedient to the protocols the Vatican has issued.
What do you think needs to happen right now?
Well, they have to be—they have to take action, and they have to be made to take action. That is, this lawsuit and others like it that we are bringing are really demanding that they disgorge the secrets, that is, the names of the offenders and all the files that evidence crimes committed, current and present, and they come forth with that, turn it over to law enforcement, discipline the bishops, the archbishops, and every top Vatican official that has been complicit in this cover-up, and come clean with the history that has now been revealed to us, so that the children are better protected, and that law enforcement and people outside the clerical culture are dealing with this instead of the Vatican and those under their control.
Jeff Anderson, you have filed hundreds of lawsuits on behalf of sexual abuse survivors. Why do you think we're coming to a different point right now?
Well, we're really coming to a tipping point now, because there has been now an accumulation of revelations over the last quarter century that have revealed to us and now are revealing to the public, both in the U.S. and now worldwide, that there is an enormous problem, that all of us have been deferential to the Vatican and the Vatican officials, that is particularly acute, and the documents that have come through the lawsuits and the courage of the survivors finding their voice are now finally revealing to us and to the courts that it is not being addressed, and that nothing has really fundamentally changed in the clerical culture. And at the decision of the pontiff and at the Vatican, they are fundamentally still operating under the same protocols of secrecy and self-protection that they did 100 years ago.
Jeff Anderson, I want to thank you for being with us. Jeff Anderson is a St. Paul-based attorney who has filed hundreds of lawsuits alleging sexual abuse on the part of priests and bishops. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We spend the rest of the hour in a rare extended interview with the punk rock legend Patti Smith.
Grateful by
Patti Smith, performed in our Democracy Now! Studios in New York on Monday night as we launched the greenest internet, TV, radio studios in the country. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we are broadcasting from Minneapolis. Well, Patti Smith, the singer, songwriter, poet, artist, and punk rock legend, joined us on Monday evening to perform some of her songs and to sit down for an extended interview about her life, about her art, about singing and speaking out. Patti Smith's influential debut album, Horses, came out in 1975 to critical acclaim. Her best-known song, Because the Night, was co-written with Bruce Springsteen. It was number 13 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart in 1978. More recently, Patti Smith has performed in numerous anti-war rallies. She's written songs about American peace activist Rachel Corrie, the Israeli assault on the Lebanese village of Khana, and Murat Kurnaz, a Turkish citizen of Germany, who was imprisoned at Guantanamo for 5 years. Patti Smith is just out with a new memoir. It's called Just Kids, and it tells the story of her lifelong friendship and creative collaboration with the renowned photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. On Monday night, Patti Smith began with a spoken word performance of a song that's become a protest anthem, People Have the Power.
In 1980, six, I believe it was, my late husband and I wrote a song that, which we wrote for all people. And it's too complicated for me to play, but I remember I was backstage at some rally, and I can't even remember what it was for, but I was standing there with Howard Zinn, and he said he really wanted to hear me do the song, but I didn't know how to play it, so I figured, well, I didn't want to let Howard down, so I figured I could just speak it. So I'll do the same, remembering Howard. I was dreaming in my dreaming of an aspect bright and fair, and my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the form of shining valleys where the pure air recognized and my senses newly opened and I awakened to the cry that the people have the power.
That the people have the power to redeem the work of fools. Upon the meek, the gracious shower is decreed. I thought you might like to know as a footnote, the way that song was written was I was in the kitchen peeling potatoes. And, you know, I had one kid at my feet and another kid, you know, running around, carrying on and just peeling potatoes, cursing to myself. And my husband came in. He said, Trisha. I said, yes, Captain. And he said, people have the power. Write it. And I said, and so I did.
Became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their gear. And the shepherds and the soldiers. Shine.
Patti Smith on People Have the Power. Well, on Monday night, before a studio audience in New York, Democracy Now!'s Anjali Kamat and I sat down with Patti Smith to talk about, well, her music, her early life in New York, and her political activism.
It's a great privilege to be here with Patti Smith. And, well, I'll just start with, Patti, how did you end up here in New York? Where were you born?
I did end up here at this stage with
we'll
you.
We'll get there.
Well, I was actually born in Chicago, and then when I was a toddler, my parents moved to Philadelphia. My dad got a job in a factory in Philadelphia. So I was raised in Germantown in a sort of a barracks where, for soldiers, they had housing for temporary housing, and then my parents saved money and bought a little house in South Jersey, built on a swamp, and I lived there till 1967. And, you know, I had a great childhood. We were a lower middle class family with a lot of financial struggle, but very happy, open-minded family. My parents were very humanistic. But where we lived was not the cultural center of the world, hardly. So I came to New York for two reasons, to find my own kin and also to get a job. And that's what I came to New York for in 67. Got me a job in a bookstore, and so that was great. So.
And Patti Smith, how did you become a musician? You've been called the godmother of punk.
Well, I never became a musician, obviously. I never wanted to be a musician. The only thing I daydream about was being an opera singer, but I was so skinny and so pathetic that that sort of wasn't going to happen. I really evolved as a performer. I think I'm a natural performer, but not really a real musician. I was writing poetry, and in performing poetry, it just became more aggressive, more energetic, more oral. I grew up at the same time as rock and roll grew up, so rock and roll became was part of a great part of my vocabulary and our cultural voice, and I just merged my poetry with what I knew best was rock and roll, but. To this day, I wouldn't call myself a musician. I would say I was a performer, but I have two kids who actually are musicians who remind me that I'm not a musician quite often.
How old are they?
My kids are 27 and 22.
Mm-hmm. I bet everyone in this audience's audience wishes they weren't a musician like you're not. But who influenced you most as you came to New York?
Well, I mean, I had a plethora of influences. I mean, one of my earliest influences was Joan March in Little Women, you know, because she was a writer, a tomboy. She went out to help her family, and she was probably my first real role model, and that followed with all kinds of people. Lotta Lenya, Bob Dylan was a very important influence. Joan Baez was very important, and John Coltrane. And I just, there's so many artists and poets and musicians and activists that I've drawn inspiration from. That to me is one of the great parts of life is all the work of other people and how it influences and inspires us.
And your latest book, Just Kids, it chronicles your friendship with Robert Mapplethorpe, the great artist. Can you talk about your friendship with Mapplethorpe over 22 years?
Well, I met Robert in 1967. I came to New York with nothing. I had a lot of bravado. I had a few dollars in my pocket, but I had a good work ethic. I knew I wanted a job, and that's what I was looking for. And I also didn't feel any fear in New York City. I really love New York. I was brought up in a very rural community, and we didn't have cars. The roads were dark. There was nowhere to go. You'd have to walk like 4 or 5 miles to, you know, go to a pizza place. And, you know, New York, where everything was right there, there was all kinds of places to get coffee. You could sleep on the subway. You know, it seemed like the safest place in the world. So, and in the middle of this atmosphere, I met Robert quite accidentally. And we were both quite, we were more alike than not. We were the same age. Both wanted to be artists, both had nothing, and both sort of on the fringe of things. You know, both of us were more the late bloomer type, and, you know, despite the fact that Robert was, you know, had a very engaging face, he was still sort of a wallflower, a person on the fringe, even in an art school. So we gravitated toward each other and supported each other and evolved together and went through all kinds of things, you know, from, you know, Robert discovering or coming to terms with his evolving sexual identity to becoming a photographer, me evolving from poetry into rock and roll, and we evolved together.
And he took the iconic photograph of you on the cover of your first album?
Yeah, he did. He did. And we did that just like we did everything else. Our relationship was built on trust. And, you know, sometimes people ask me about how we took this picture like it was some big drama. Like, now you get your picture taken and the photo shoot that you'd think they were doing a movie, there's like catering and, you know four monitors and a bunch of, you know, people running. It's like a Peter Sellers movie, you know. And really, it was just me and Robert, you know, in a white room and with natural light. And in fact, his light meter was broken. So it was just, he took 12 shots and we got it.
You know, the geography of this city tells so many stories, and Democracy Now! Has just moved from this 100-year-old firehouse. Our dear friends, who could think you're calling your landlords your friends, but Keiko Tsuno and John Alpert, I hope they're here tonight. I'm not sure if they are, but really embraced us and protected us until we outgrew this firehouse because they were growing as well, downtown community media center. And so we ended up here in Chelsea, just around the corner from the Chelsea Hotel.
Yes.
So talk about 1969 and you and Robert going there.
Well, first of all, I just want to say that there's nothing better than to be able to say that you had to move because democracy was growing. So, Robert and I were both, we went through a lot of different things, and in 1969, we were a bit down on our luck, and we had heard that if you went to the Chelsea Hotel, they would often trade art for a room, and we went to the Chelsea Hotel, and I checked out the lobby, and the stuff was pretty bad, and I thought, oh, we won't have any problem, but Mr. Bard was not really interested in our work, but he was interested in the fact that I had employment, which was something that probably 70% of the people of the hotel did not have. Who was there at the time? Well, the first person we met in the lobby was Harry Smith, who was definitely not employed. But we saw all kinds of people there. I mean, there was a lot of artists and writers. Virgil Thompson lived there. I'd say Shirley Clark. I saw Jonas Mekas there a lot, and Allen Ginsberg, and just about, I mean, we could go on and on with lists of people. Even Arthur C. Clarke lived there, you know. So I talked Mr. Bard into, you know, letting us have a room based on the fact that I had a job. We had the smallest room in the hotel, which doesn't even exist anymore. It had no bathroom. It was $55 a week, and I made $65 at Scribner's Bookstore. So that pretty much could say what our living situation was. But it was a really a great stroke of luck to move it to Chelsea, because the people that we met there, Gregory Corso and William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg, I met Bobby Neuwirth and so many musicians, people you never heard of and people who, you know, we all revere. And I think I said it in the book, but it's true. It became my new university. I couldn't think of a better place to be at the time, because I learned so much about everything, about painting and poetry, performance, activism, all in this one hotel.
Mm-hmm. 2 years later, 1971, talk about putting poetry to music.
Well, sorry, well, I had my first poetry reading. It was on Bertolt Brecht's birthday, February 10th, 1971. It was a full moon. I was opening up Gerard Malanga and at St. Mark's Church. And of course, St. Mark's Church was the, you know, the mecca for poets at the time. And it was quite an honor to get 18 minutes at St. Mark's Church. So I really wanted to do something special. And also, I knew Gregory Corso really good, and he would really harass you if you were boring. I mean, he would sit in the back, way back there, and if you were boring, you could hear him all the way from back there letting you know that you were really boring. And I asked Lenny Kaye to play some interpretive electric guitar, a little feedback to some of, to certain of the poems. And I didn't think much about it. I just thought, you know, it was sort of like Kerouac and Steve Allen playing together. It's just only with electric guitar. But it seemed to cause a bit of a stir. And I guess that's how it began. Still stirring.
Patti Smith, singing and speaking before a Democracy Now! Studio audience on Monday night. Stay with us.
I was a wing in heaven blue on the ocean, soared over Spain, and I was free. I needed nobody. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. I was a pawn, couldn't make a move, couldn't go nowhere, no future at all. Yet I was free. I needed nobody. Was beautiful. And if there's one thing could do for you, you'd be a wing in heaven blue. I was a vision in another eye.
Patti Smith, singing Wing in our Democracy Now! Studio before a studio audience Monday night. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we go back to our conversation with rocker Patti Smith. Anjali Kamat and I interviewed her in Democracy Now!'s new studios.
And you talked a little bit about your activism. Some of your more recent music is also sort of builds on these themes, and you had a song called Kana, a song about a detainee who was in Guantanamo. Can you talk a little bit about these songs?
Well, I mean, I would never call myself an activist ever. I don't really I hope that I'm a humanist and sort of a good citizen. I really think of the people who are out there in the front lines every day, and I'm so grateful to all of you. I think of activism on many levels, the people that are out in the trenches, and then the citizens who can do just small things, the smallest things. And one of the things that I can do is respond to things that are unjust, or and hopefully by putting it out into the world, free, putting it on websites, these songs, maybe it'll be of good use. The song that she was talking about Guantanamo Bay, I wrote in response to Murat Kurnaz. He was a boy the same age as my son, and he was detained for suspicious travel. He was German and Muslim, which made him very suspicious after September 11th. And wound up in Guantanamo Bay without any real charges, just a comedy of, or not a very, like a very black comedy of errors, brought this boy for like 5 years chained in a very small room, never with the lights out. He had lights on 24 hours a day. He couldn't really lay his whole body down on the floor because his cell was too small, and he stayed there for 5 years. And when they finally did get him out, when he was finally released, he was put on a plane, chained to the floor, with soldiers surrounding him with machine guns and guns, and that was his first taste of freedom. And because he's the same age of my—well, because he's a human being, but also as a mother, I was so horrified by this, imagining, projecting that if this was my son. And so I wrote the song, Without Chains. The gist of the song is it tells his story, but it says in the end, they say I walk strange. Because he's walking, when he greets his parents, they finally take the chains off, and he fell to the ground because he wasn't used to not having chains. And it's the song talks about how he now has to learn to love without chains, vote without chains, dance without chains, breathe without chains. Little things. I wrote the song. I put it on my website. I gave it to people. And then I was in playing in a church in Germany, and the boy that I wrote the song and his lawyer came to see me at this church. And they told me that when he got out of prison, his lawyer took him for a ride and showed him an iPod, you know, for the first time. And put the song on, and the young fellow was so moved and happy to see that anybody cared about him in those years, and enough to write a rock and roll song. And he's a young fella, and hearing a rock and roll song about him and his situation made him really happy. And the other nice thing is he has actually become
he goes around and tries to help other people, tries to help people who have been in the same situation, and is in conducting his life as well as he can without bitterness. So it's you know, it has its positive resonance.
What about independent music? I mean, we talk a lot about the importance of independent media in a time, in these critical times of war and peace, of life and death. But talk about the music world, the art world. You're a photographer as well. And
well,
how you maintain that independence.
Well, I maintain it because that's all I ever wanted. I mean, I never cared about having a career, so I made all my decisions based on protecting my work. So it could be a simple decision, like if you get $100,000 and do what they tell you, or you can get $20,000 and do what you want. And I was like, no problem. $20,000 sounds fine to me. I've always chosen that route in everything I do. And you know, people say, who say that you can't, it's just not true. You know, you can do. We are the master. Pretty much of our own situation. And, you know, if one wants a mainstream career, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. You just, that's what you should go for. I wouldn't whine because I don't have hit records and stuff. I haven't written any, and I don't engage in the world that would, put me in that position. I do things that, you know, make people upset. My political views or my humanist views have caused me a lot of censorship. But I don't have a problem with that. I mean, it isn't right. But what I would have more of a problem is if I had to look back in my life and say, yeah, I compromised here, and yeah, I did this so I could get that. Once you start doing that, it's like a house of cards. It all falls apart. You know, it's you can't make any shortcuts, and you just got to. It's all a question of what you want out of life. You know, if you wanted to be an anchor woman on Fox News, perhaps, and you could. make certain choices that would have put you there, including, you know, becoming a blonde, you know. But I just do whatever. It's like Mother Teresa used to say, she did things according to the need. And I do things according to the need. I have a record company. And I make records on big I'll be doing a record on Columbia, but I'll do the record that I want to do. I'm old-fashioned. I was brought up with a record company like Columbia has a lot of historical significance to me. You know, it was Bob Dylan's label. You know, I'm really proud to be on Columbia Records, but in my own way. But also, I also put out a lot of stuff for free in my own way. And I just think you just, you know, one can make a living and do it the best way they can. And then we serve the people for free the best way we can. You have to do both joyfully. You know, I'm really, it's just like, if you're not gonna do stuff joyfully, you shouldn't do it. I mean, I never believed there should be a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I was really opposed to it, but they made one. And
then they inducted you into it.
After much strife. But, and then I had to think about this moral question, you know. Should I accept something that I was opposed to? Well, I was opposed to it, but it exists, and it's also an honor to be recognized within our cultural voice. And I decided that it would make my parents really proud, that I would accept it happily, not cynically. Because if you're going to do stuff cynically, then you shouldn't do it.
And so I don't know if that answers your question. I can't even remember what the question was, but I'm such a rambler.
You're saying commercial success is not what motivated you as an artist.
No, but yes, it didn't motivate me as an artist, but I don't think it's criminal to have commercial success. I did have some commercial success in the 70s when I did a song with Bruce Springsteen, and it was my biggest commercial success. And I was proud of the song. I was happy that people liked it. Believe me, when Fred and I wrote People of the Power, we used to daydream that everybody in the world would love it and buy it, and that the whole world would be singing it, and we'd make millions of dollars. Only joke, just joking. But when I think of commercial success, I think of the fact that if you can do something that touches the public nerve, and with integrity, all the better, because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to communicate, you know, important ideas. That's what's so great about, you know, Michael Moore's movies. You know, he, like, has touched the public nerve. The more successful his movies become, all the better for all of us. You know, it's not an exclusive thing. You know, if you're doing something that is going to benefit all of the people, we don't want it to be, you know, exclusive. That's why it's so great that Amy needed a bigger space. You know, it's very cool to be in the little firehouse, and you know, it's nostalgic and wonderful. But all the better to see it grow and get too big, and may it get too big for this place.
Rock legend Patti Smith in our Democracy Now! Studios. She concluded our conversation with the song she wrote with Bruce Springsteen, Because the Night.
Take me now, baby, here as I am. Pull me close, try and understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed. Come on now, try and understand the way I feel when I'm in your hands. Take my hand as the sun descends. They can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now, wow, 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 wow. Because the night belongs to lovers.
Because the night
belongs to us.
Because the night
belongs to lovers. Because the night belongs to us. Have I doubt when I'm alone? Love is a ring, the telephone. Love is an angel disguised as lust, here in our bed until the morning comes. But come on now, try and understand.
Democracy Now! That concludes this show. If you'd like a copy of this broadcast with Patti Smith, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadous, Aaron Mate, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Steve Martinez, Robbie Karen, Anjali Comet, Mike DeFilippo, Peter Curries, and Miguel Naguera, our engineers. Special thanks also to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Karen Renucci. I'll be speaking at Stanford Law School tonight. Go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Because the night belongs to lovers.
Because the night
belongs to us. Now here's the part where Lenny Kaye does his guitar solo, and everybody gets excited, and the people get up, and everybody...